I'm Cassandra Earle. You are listening to News and Views at RadioRegent.com, and this is your weekly news roundup, beginning with international news. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said this week that India and the U.S. are working together to develop a vaccine for the coronavirus pandemic. In the past, the countries have worked together to try to stop diseases like influenza and tuberculosis. India itself is home to some of the largest manufacturers of drugs and vaccines in the world, hosting half a dozen large vaccine makers and many smaller ones, such as manufacturers that work to fight against meningitis, polio, and pneumonia. Now, half a dozen of these large Indian manufacturers are working to find a vaccine for COVID-19. One of the manufacturers working to find the vaccine is Serum Institute of India, which is the world's largest vaccine maker by the number of doses that are produced and sold globally. The company supplies around 20 vaccines to 165 countries, with 80% of their vaccines being exported. Now the company has teamed up with the American firm Cotagenix, a biotech company, to develop a vaccine for COVID-19. However, experts warn against the public expecting a vaccine on the market anytime soon. As some countries prepare to slowly open up again after handling coronavirus outbreaks, new measures are being taken and not all of them effective. A local beach in Spain was sprayed with diluted bleach in an effort to protect residents from COVID-19. Tractors equipped with sprayers were sent to the beach to apply the diluted bleach to the area ahead of the country lifting restrictions against children going outside. Lifting the restriction would allow for children under 14 years old to have daily outings for up to an hour. Disinfecting the beach with the diluted bleach is a concern for environmentalists who remind others that the beach is a living ecosystem and spraying it with chemicals kills off everything. An official with the regional government in the area claims the local officials and business owners that organized spraying the bleach did not have necessary permissions. Another official apologized, stating they agree it was an error on their part, but that they had good intentions. Spain has been one of the hardest hit countries so far, with almost 23,800 deaths. In local news, on Monday, Ontario health officials confirmed another 424 cases of COVID-19, as well as 57 more deaths. This is the lowest number of patients reported in a single day since April 13th, but also the highest death count since the province began tracking cases earlier this year. The number of deaths related to COVID-19 in Ontario is nearing 900. 39 of those who have died were between the ages of 40 and 59, while 241 people who have died were between the ages of 60 and 79. Of the deceased patients in Ontario, 607 were older than 79, which remains the hardest hit age group. Ontario also reported 3 more outbreaks at long-term care facilities, which brings the total number of care homes facing the virus to 170. 945 patients are currently in the hospital being cared for, with 241 patients in the ICU, and of those patients in the ICU, 191 are on ventilators. But as of now, 8,525 cases of COVID-19 have been resolved in Ontario, which is about 50% of Ontario's cases. I'm Cassandra Earle. You are listening to News and Views at RadioRegent.com, and this has been your weekly news roundup.
Here's an interview conducted by Wayne Greenway with public health physician Dr. David Mowat, in which they discuss possible exit strategies from COVID-19 virus societal restrictions.
As of Wednesday, April the 15th, 2020, more than 1,000 deaths in Canada have been linked to the COVID-19 outbreak, according to CBC News tally of deaths attributed to the virus. The pandemic has strained health systems, caused deadly outbreaks at long-term care homes, and sparked strict public health measures aimed at slowing the spread of the novel virus, the CBC reported. Physical distancing is still the greatest weapon the world has against the spread of virus, and we seem to be doing a little better at it. On Wednesday, April the 15th, 2020, the Toronto Star reported the Chief Public Health Officer, Dr. Theresa Tam, is saying that the number of cases in the country is now doubling every 10 days or so, compared to every 3 days in late March, which means that the epidemic is slowing down. But Tam warned emerging from COVID-19 would be like making our way down the mountain in the darkness, stressing that it's too soon to ease physical distancing measures. We mustn't rush or let go of our safety measures, or the fall will be hard and unforgiving, she said. On March 27, 2020, the Harvard Gazette said that the research indicates that one possible method for dealing with the epidemic amid a lack of other effective interventions may be multiple intermittent social distancing periods that ease up when cases fall to a certain level and then are reimposed when they rise past a key threshold. Today on News and Views, to talk about the way experts will plan our exit strategy out of COVID, we're pleased to have with us Dr. David Mowat. Before we begin, let me tell you a little about Dr. David Mowat. Dr. David Mowat is a public health physician whose career has spanned positions at the local, provincial, and national levels. He has a particular interest in the prevention of chronic disease through action at the population level, especially policy change and developing healthy environments, including the built environment. In Ontario, Dr. Mowat served as Medical Officer of Health for Peel Region and for Kingston and area, and served two terms as the Chief Medical Officer of Health. He was also Deputy Chief Public Health Officer at the Public Health Agency of Canada, and has worked for the Government of Newfoundland and Labrador for the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer. Dr. Mowat received his medical training at the University of Edinburgh and a master's degree in public health from the University of California at Berkeley. He is also a fellow in the public health and preventive medicine of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada. Welcome to News and Views, Dr. David Mowat.
Thank you, Wayne. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Okay. So let's get started. Could you help us understand how the experts will determine how the Ministry of Health will likely make recommendations on easing physical isolation or on moving forward?
Well, I think the first thing to say is it's not just the Ministry of Health. I think, of course, governments look first to advice from health experts, but these decisions involve, in fact, the federal government, the provincial government, and municipal government. And for example, the city of Toronto has a very large structure constantly working to address the COVID-19 epidemic. Now, there's no vaccine or treatment yet. So the only way we can tackle this issue is by reducing the risk of contracting the virus. And I'm sure the listeners are familiar with all of the things we have to do or all of the things we can't do to get to that point. There is, however, a price that we pay for this, and it's both economic disruption and, you know, many small businesses closed, many people unemployed, and the social disruption. I think people are responding very, very well to this, and we're really pulling together, but it is going to get more tedious as time goes on and more difficult to stick with this. So we need to decide how we're going to gradually exit the current policies without starting that graph going up again, and especially the deaths increasing. As you know, the current strategy is to flatten the curve. So you spread the curve, the cases out, so that they don't overwhelm the healthcare system, and to give us time to build up the capacity of the healthcare system to get more supplies, get more equipment, and of course, while we're doing that, looking for treatments and looking for a vaccine. That has worked very well so far. However, it can't go on for much longer. And what people may not have realized is that this virus is not going away until we have immunity from it. And there's only two ways to get that immunity. That is to actually get it, and it would probably take at the very least 60% of people to have actually got an infection, even though in some cases they may not know they've had the infection. But to be infected, 60% of the population, before we have this so-called herd immunity, so that we stop it going around. Or a better way, if we can do it, of course, is to immunize the entire population. Until then, we have got to do something to keep the lid on this. Mm-hmm. And that means coming up with a strategy to move from where we are now to, I call it an exit strategy. So I can just mention what's in that if you want.
Right. I was just going to ask.
Yeah. So right now, what we're doing is keeping the entire population away from everybody else in the population, right? So right. That the virus can't jump between people. So that's the social distances and so on. So we need to move from that. Once we've reduced the number of cases enough so that we can use another method. And that other method is to surveillance of the disease, identifying cases, contact tracing, and isolation and quarantine of cases and contacts, all supported by a lot of testing. Now, that is a big deal. It's very similar to the way public health staff tackle other communicable diseases, but on a massive scale. So you've got to get all of the testing equipment, you've got to train everybody up, and we've got to do it. And we should not ease up on the other measures until we're ready to roll with that approach, which, you know, is on its way. Plus, we continue, obviously, to work on building up acute health care and long-term care. And for the vulnerable population, I believe we should continue the distancing. So that's essentially everybody over 70, plus people with, you know, diseases that put them at higher risk. And, you know, we may need to back up at some point. And, you know, reinstate some of these other measures if we see the cases going up again. But the plan is move to this other way of dealing with it and ease up on the restrictions. And, of course, number one priority, get people back to work.
Right. So, what you're describing is that we would increase testing for people who, would we increase testing for everyone,
Well, I mean, there's a priority of some pretty obvious priorities for testing. When we get more testing capacity,
right.
Obviously, healthcare workers. Long-term care workers, long-term care residents are the top of the list, right? We
right.
might also say, who are the people who are going to, after that, who are going to be in contact with other people? Now, the grocery store workers, service industry workers, you know, I mean, if you were to ask me at a personal level, what's the number one thing I want back? I want my hairdresser back, right? And it's going to be very, very difficult. You know, you can't do that at a distance of 6 feet.
No.
That's the problem. So,
right.
You know, so we might require masks for the customer and the worker, that kind of thing for them. But the basis is we have to have extensive testing. Right now we test for the virus. The problem with that is if you're negative on the test, you might not be negative next week. So you've got to repeat it, maybe every
right.
week.
Right.
What we'd like to get is an antibody test. And people are working on that. And that would say you're immune. Right?
I see. And how would they
that
do
would
an
test you for immunity? Well, it's a blood test.
Right.
You know, some of them they're developing now need a very small amount of blood, and you get the answer fairly quickly.
Right.
if you are immune, then that's fantastic, right? You're not going to get sick again after you've either had the illness or the vaccine, and you're not going to pass on the virus to anybody else. So that's another form of testing, which I'm fairly confident we will get underway, you know, sometime in the future. And this way, we will continue to isolate the people who are at high risk. That is because we know they're positive and spreading the virus potentially, or we know they've been in contact, close contact with such a person. And the idea is to track them all down and, you know, put them in isolation for, say, 2 weeks or until, you know, we've determined they're immune.
That's really helpful. So, and I know you don't have a crystal ball, but do you, and maybe you've already answered this in a way, but do you foresee more waves of this coming? Do you see more, do you think there's more pandemics on the horizon? Any thoughts on that?
Well, in terms of what else could come to plague us, this very clearly is the biggest health event in 100 years.
Right.
Since, you know, the 1918-19 flu pandemic. And let us hope we're not going to get one for another 100 years. But, you know, this is about a virus which has jumped the species barrier. This is what this is about. So was SARS. So was MERS. So was H1N1 flu. We seem to be getting more of these species jumping, where we are mixing the genetic material from human viruses and animal viruses. And I'm really not an expert on that, but clearly, you know, there are some conditions in societies which are making that more common now. And if we can do something to prevent that, we should. But it'll continue to be a problem. Could there be a second wave? Yes, there could be a second wave. I do believe that if we have a very large effort to identify cases and contacts and isolate them and test extensively, we can keep this at a very low level, and we have international examples of that. Iceland, Singapore, South Korea, etc., have used that method and had a lot of success with it. So it is possible. It's impossible, however, to rule out some form of second wave, which I think would clearly be not as extensive as the first wave we're in at the moment.
Right. Well, I just have one more question. I wondered if you'd like to comment on Donald Trump's decision not to fund the World Health Organization as a result of their...
Right. Well, I mean, the WHO is not perfect. Let us say that. But people don't realize the WHO is not a vast multi-billion-dollar organization. It is not. It's very modest because it doesn't have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You know, as far as the United States is concerned, I think if you look at other countries that are doing a lot better than the United States, they took their advice from the WHO also. Maybe it's not the WHO. Maybe it's something in the United States. Maybe it's the fact that they abolished their pandemic planning department in 2018. And you should also consider that we know now that the U.S. government was warned by their medical intelligence people on the 23rd of February, which was 15 days before the pandemic outbreak was declared by the WHO, that they had increased their threat level to 1, which is the highest, and that a pandemic was imminent within the next 30 days. So that was internal U.S. government advice, which was ignored. That same day, President Trump was saying, this virus is completely under control. So we all know what's going on here. You got to find somebody else to blame. And he's picked on the WHO. I think the blame lies closer to home.
Well, thank you, Dr. Mowat. It was very well, that question was very well summarized, and I've appreciated your answers to all of my questions. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank you for being part of Radio Regent's News and Views, and it's just been a pleasure to have you as a guest again on News and Views, and to learn more about our exit strategy out of COVID, and what might play out in the future. So thanks again for being part of News and Views.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
That was Wayne Greenway in conversation with Dr. David Mowat. You're listening to Radio Regent at radioregent.com.